spent our lives wishing that we had a child. I do not believe that we could have ever had a better young man than you, Bob.
He looked up at his son with pride.
Well, yes, thank you, but...
He turned to his mother, certain he could get her to tell him what was happening, but she was no longer there.
Where did she go?
Oh, yes.
Mr. Owens seemed ill at ease.
You know, Betsy, there's things, times, when, well, you don't know what to say. You know?
No.
I expect Silas is waiting for you,
said his father. And then he was gone. It was past midnight. Bod began to walk toward the old chapel. The tree that grew out of the gutter on the spire had fallen in the last storm, taking a handful of the slate-black roof tiles with it. Bod waited on the grey wooden bench. But there was no sign of Silas. The wind gusted. It was late on a summer's night, when the twilight lasts forever, and it was warm, but still Bod felt goose pimples rising on his arms. A voice by his ear said,
"Say you'll miss me, you lumpkin."
"Liza?"
He had not seen or heard from the witch girl for over a year, not since the night of the Jacks of All Trades.
"Where have you been?"
"Watching. Does a lady have to tell everything she does?"
"Watching me?"
Liza's voice, close to his ear, said,
"Truly, life is wasted on the living, Nobody Owens. For one of us is too foolish to live, and it is not I. Say you will miss me."
"Where are you going?" "Of course I will miss you, wherever you go."
"Too stupid,"
whispered Liza Hempstock's voice, and he could feel the touch of her hand on his hand.
"Too stupid to live."
The touch of her lips against his cheek, against the corner of his lips. She kissed him gently, and he was too perplexed, too utterly wrong-footed to know what to do.
"I will miss you too. Always."
A breath of wind ruffled his hair, if it was not the touch of her hand, and then he was, he knew, alone on the bench. He got up. Bod walked over to the chapel door, lifted the stone beside the porch, and pulled out the spare key, left there by a long-dead sexton. He unlocked the big wooden door without even testing to see if he could slip through it. It creaked open, protesting. The inside of the chapel was dark, and Bod found himself squinting as he tried to see.
"Come in, Bod."
"I can't see anything. It's too dark."
"Already?"
He sighed. Bod heard a velvet rustle, then a match was struck, and it flamed, and was used to light two huge candles that sat on great carved wooden candlesticks at the back of the room. In the candlelight, Bod could see his guardian standing beside a large leather chest, of the kind they call a steamer trunk, big enough that a tall man could have curled up and slept inside it. Beside it was Silas's black leather bag, which Bod had seen before on a handful of occasions, but which he still found impressive. The steamer trunk was lined with whiteness. Bod put a hand into the empty trunk, touched the silk lining, touched dried earth.
"Is this where you sleep?"
"When I am far from my house, yes."
Bod was taken aback. Silas had been here as long as he could remember, and before.
"Isn't this your home?"
Silas shook his head.
"My house is a long, long way from here. That is, if it is still habitable. There have been problems in my native land, and I am far from certain what I will find on my return."
"You're going back?"
Things that had been immutable were changing.
You're really leaving? But you're my guardian.
I was your guardian. But you are old enough to guard yourself. I have other things to protect.
Silas closed the lid of the brown leather trunk and began to do up the straps and the buckles.
Can't I stay here? In the graveyard?
You must not,
said Silas, more gently than Bod could remember him ever saying anything.
All the people here have had their lives, Bod, even if they were short ones. Now it's your turn. You need to live.
Can I come with you?
Silas shook his head.
Will I see you again?
Perhaps.
There was kindness in Silas's voice, and something more.
And whether you see me or not, I have no doubt that I will see you.
He put the leather trunk against the wall, walked over to the door in the far corner.
Follow me.
Bod walked behind Silas, followed him down the small spiral staircase to the crypt.
I took the liberty of packing a case for you,
Silas explained, as they reached the bottom. On top of the box of mildewed hymn books was a small leather suitcase, a miniature twin to Silas's own.
Your possessions are all in there.
Tell me about the honour guard, Silas. You're in it. Miss Lupescu was. Who else? Are there a lot of you? What do you do?
We don't do enough. And mostly we guard the borderlands. We protect the borders of things.
What kind of borders?
Silas said nothing.
You mean like stopping the man Jack and his people?
We do what we have to.
But you did the right thing. I mean, stopping the Jacks. They were terrible. They were monsters.
Silas took a step closer to Bod, which made the youth tilt back his head to look up at the tall man's pale face.
I have not always done the right thing. When I was younger, I did worse things than Jack. Worse than any of them. I was the monster then, Bod, and worse than any monster.
It did not even cross Bod's mind to wonder if his guardian was lying or joking. He knew that he was being told the truth.
But you aren't that any longer, are you?
People can change.
Bod wondered if his guardian, if Silas, was remembering.
It was an honour to be your guardian, young man.
His hand vanished inside his cloak, reappeared, holding a battered old wallet.
This is for you. Take it.
Bod took the wallet, but did not open it.
It contains money. Enough to give you a start in the world, but nothing more.
I went to see Alonzo Jones today, but he wasn't there. Or if he was, I couldn't see him. I wanted him to tell me about distant places he'd visited. Islands and porpoises, and glaciers and mountains. Places where people dress and eat in the strangest ways. Those places, they're still there. I mean, there's a whole world out there. Can I see it? Can I go there?
Silas nodded.
There is a whole world out there, yes. You have a passport in the inner pocket of your suitcase. It's made out in the name of Nobody Owens, and was not easy to obtain.
If I change my mind, can I come back here?
And then he answered his own question.
If I come back, it will be a place. But it won't be home any longer.
Would you like me to walk you to the front gate?
Bod shook his head.
Best if I do it on my own. Silas, if you're ever in trouble, call me. I'll come and help.
I do not get into trouble.
No. I don't suppose you do. But still.
It was dark in the crypt, and it smelled of mildew and damp and old stones, and it seemed, for the first time, very small.
I want to see life. I want to hold it in my hands. I want to leave a footprint on the sand of a desert island. I want to play football with people. I want...
Then he paused, and he thought...
I want everything.
Good.
Then he put up his hand, as if he were brushing away the hair from his eyes, a most uncharacteristic gesture.
If ever it transpires that I am in trouble, I shall indeed send for you.
Even though you don't get into trouble?
As you say.
There was something at the edge of Silas's lips that might have been a smile, and might have been regret, and might just have been a trick of the shadows.
Goodbye, then, Silas.
Bod held out his hand, as he had when he was a small boy, and Silas took it, in a cold hand, the colour of old ivory, and shook it gravely.
Goodbye, Nobody Owens.
Bod picked up the little suitcase. He opened the door to let himself out of the crypt, walked back up the gentle slope to the path, without looking back. It was well after the gates were locked. He wondered, as he reached them, if the gates would still let him walk through them, or if he would have to go back into the chapel to get a key. But when he got to the entrance, he found the small pedestrian gate was unlocked, and wide open, as if it was waiting for him. As if the graveyard itself was bidding him goodbye. One pale, plump figure waited in front of the open gate, and she smiled up at him as he came towards her, and there were tears in her eyes in the moonlight.
Hello, Mother.
Mistress Owens rubbed her eyes with a knuckle, then dabbed at them with her apron, and she shook her head.
Do you know what you're going to do now?
See the world. Get into trouble, get out of trouble again, visit jungles and volcanoes and deserts and islands and people. I want to meet an awful lot of people.
Mistress Owens made no immediate reply. She stared up at him, and then she began to sing a song that Bod remembered, a song she used to sing him when he was a tiny thing. A song that she had used to lull him to sleep when he was small.
Sleep, my little babby-o, sleep until you waken. When you wake, you'll see the world, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not. And I shall.
Kiss a lover, dance a measure, find your name, and buried treasure.
Then the last lines of the song came back to Mistress Owens, and she sang them to her son.
Face your life, its pain, its pleasure. Leave no path untaken.
Leave no path untaken. A difficult challenge, but I can try my best.
He tried to put his arms around his mother then, as he had when he was a child, although he might as well have been trying to hold mist, for he was alone on the path. He took a step forward, through the gate that took him out of the graveyard. He thought a voice said,
I am so proud of you, my son.
But he might perhaps have imagined it. The midsummer sky was already beginning to lighten in the east, And that was the way the Bod began to walk. Down the hill, towards the living people and the city and the dawn. There was a passport in his bag, money in his pocket. There was a smile dancing on his lips, although it was a wary smile, for the world is a bigger place than a little graveyard on a hill, and there would be dangers in it, and mysteries, new friends to make, old friends to rediscover, mistakes to be made, and many paths to be walked, before he would finally return to the graveyard, or ride with the lady on the broad back of her great grey stallion. But between now and then, there was life, and Bod walked into it with his eyes and his heart wide open.
The Story Behind the Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman. And this is Neil Gaiman. We were young and very poor. The rooms I was renting above a shop were in a building tall and spindly and old. The kitchen and lounge were on one floor, a bedroom and my office and a bathroom on the next, and at the top of the house there was a big attic bedroom and a low, long room in which an adult could barely stand up straight, and in which there was a crib and a playpen. My son Michael, who was 2 years old, loved his tricycle more than anything, but there was nowhere to ride it in the house, not without him tumbling down the stairs. So I would carry him and his tricycle across the narrow lane to the grounds of the local church, and he would pedal around to his heart's content, and I would sit and read a book in the sunshine, and watch him and look at the grey gravestones, names half erased by time, and marvel at how comfortable a child looks in a graveyard. That was where it started. I'll call it the Graveyard Book, I thought, like Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. I went up to my office room, and I tried to write a scene in which a handful of ghosts argue about whether to take a human child into their graveyard. A vampire showed up and shamed them into saying yes, and a werewolf volunteered to educate the child. It wasn't very good. I don't know what happened to that scene. I never threw anything out, but I've never seen it since. I thought about the book a lot. I promised myself I would become a good enough writer to do the book justice. I wrote. At one point I despaired of ever writing my book, but I still loved graveyards and still loved my idea. 10 years later, I tried again. I had been watching a documentary late one night about South American death squads. One girl had hidden herself every night in a mausoleum. The death squads did not come into the graveyard. Something that had been missing in my unwritten book came into focus. The reason for staying in the graveyard. Protection. Yes. In a cabin overlooking a Wisconsin lake, I wrote that same first scene once more. It was all I had clear in my head. But again, decided it was not good enough, again resolved to wait until I was a good enough writer to do the idea justice. I do not know where that version is either. I knew I would never go back to it. And then one day, I realized I was as good as I would ever be. Putting off my book because I wasn't good enough seemed pointless. I started a graveyard book story, one from right in the middle of the book, wrote a page, decided it was terrible, but read it to my daughter Maddie anyway because she asked what I was doing. "What happens next?" she asked. I needed to find out as well. So I kept writing the story about a ghostly witch who needed a headstone. When it was done, I went back to the beginning of the book and wrote the first chapter, and then the second and the third, each story in order. I wrote the tales in different places. The first three chapters were written in a tiny cottage in Cornwall out of season. The mists rolled in around the house like oceans, leaving the tops of hills jutting out like islands. And I wrote on a blanket in the garden when the sun shone, or inside by the fire when it didn't. I wrote the sixth chapter about Bod at school, in chilly New Orleans, in a decrepit hotel. And I finished the book in my own gazebo at the bottom of the garden, finished the novel blinking back stinging tears. I understood then, and only then, why I had not written the book as a young father. I had needed to walk the whole way with my children, to bring them up, to love them, and to learn that, at the end, you have to let them go. The beautiful gold cover that Dave McKean made for us commemorates over 1 million copies sold. I don't know what 1 million copies means. It's just a number. But I meet readers, and every reader I've met meant something real to me. They've told me about how something Silas or Eliza Hempstock, yes, she's related to the Hempstock family of the ocean at the end of the lane, or Bod himself said in the book, changed their lives. They've showed me their graveyard book tattoos, or their art. They've showed me something I can never forget, that art goes both ways. Writers tell stories and think they mean one thing. Readers take the stories into their own lives, and they mean something else. I've become a dab hand at drawing gravestones with people's names on them in the front of the book. I won't draw gravestones for infants, though, or for the unborn. It seems like tempting fate, I suppose, although I do not think of myself as a superstitious person. I learned a lot about life, writing the graveyard book, and living enough to be able to write the graveyard book. I think sometimes it would be good to look in on Silas and the rest of the honor guard and to find out what they're doing these days. I know Silas went home after the events of the book, and that he found that things had changed while he was gone. And I know that if the tale comes, it will come in its own time. Neil Gaiman, May 2014.
We hope you have enjoyed this full-cast presentation of The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman. This program was narrated by Derek Jacobi. The part of Nehemiah Trott was played by the author. Nobody Owens was played by Robert Madge. Scarlett Perkins was played by Claire Corbett. Mrs. Owens and Miss Lupescu were played by Miriam Margulies. The man Jack and Jay Frost were played by Andrew Scott. Silas was played by Julian Rind Tutt. Liza Hempstock was played by Amelia Fox. Jack Dandy, the Sleer, and Mr. Kirby were played by Rhys Shearsmith. The Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh was played by Lenny Henry. The ensemble cast included Elizabeth Bennett, Alan Corduna, Adjua Ando, Claire Corbett, Jenny Gannon, Daniel Wayman, Daniel Brocklebank, Tim Dan, and Sean Baker. This program was directed and produced by Ali Muirden. Recorded at Strathmore Studios, London. Sound editor, Jordan Killiard. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2008-2014 by Neil Gaiman. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Graveyard Lyrics by Tori Amos. Copyright 2001. Used by permission, courtesy of Sword and Stone, Inc., ASCAP. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.